Hey folks, today's episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter the offer code OFFCAMERA at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace. Build it beautiful. Hello and welcome to another edition of Off Camera. I'm your host, Sam Jones, and in this episode, I sit down with Kevin Bacon. You know, I was really excited to meet Kevin because he's been acting in films for as long as I've been watching them. His debut film, Animal House, was the first film I wasn't supposed to see, and it was completely worth the risk of being discovered and grounded for the foreseeable future. More recently, his performance in The Woodsman stands out as one of my most intense movie experiences ever. I mean, some films are disturbing, and then there's The Woodsman. And I was so curious to know how he managed to make me feel sympathy for such a horrifying character. If you've listened to my show before, you know that I love talking to people who dive deep into more than one career. Kevin is also a musician, and it's no hobby. He approaches his band with the dedication of someone who isn't spending 12 hours a day on a movie set. As someone who's been famous for the majority of his life, Kevin's learned a lot from navigating the ups and downs of a career in the public eye, which also made for some interesting conversation. As we spoke, it occurred to me that he's one of the rare artists who bridges the gap between the modern actor and the era of the classic movie star. You'll see what I mean when you hear the conversation. In this episode, Kevin joins me to talk about his early days in a family that valued creativity above all else. He shares the unexpected joys of doing a network television show, and admits to some really awkward guitar moments. I love his candid account of how abandoning a bit of snobbery and ego while holding fast to his purpose led to both personal fulfillment and the best work of his career. I've admired Kevin's work for a long time, and my chat with him was truly worth the wait. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hey Kevin, how you doing?
Sam, how you doing?
Thanks for coming and doing this.
Happy to be here.
You know, as I was combing through all of your work, I was like, Jesus, how the hell am I going to do this show? Because the body of work is amazing, and we're close to the same age, and I realized that, you know, you've been a huge part of the cinematic landscape for my entire adult life. I could do a whole season on your work, you know, and it just made me wonder, as I'm going through it, like, do you ever look back and look at the overwhelming nature of your career?
I don't really look back that much, to tell you the truth.
I mean,
I think I'm at the point in my life where people are asking me to look back, you know. They'll say, you know, let's do a career retrospective or something like that. But I'm very much like a down-the-road kind of guy. No rear-view mirror, you know. I mean, I don't look at my movies after the initial release. I mean, I look at, what I try to do is look at a first cut with alone, or maybe just with Kira, or, you know, just a handful of people, and then try to get a sense of it with an audience, and then I just kind of say goodbye. So people will say things about films, and I remember vaguely, but they'll quote lines for me that I don't really remember.
Right.
Because I'm trying to think about the next thing all the time, you know, it is good, I think, for me sometimes to look back, and these kinds of exchanges are the thing that actually creates that for me, because it doesn't come up in my normal life.
Well, it brings up an interesting question of how you mark time, because as I was thinking about this and how to start this, I thought, well, how do I mark time? Like, what's the slideshow in my life? And I think it's like these milestones, you know, like first big job as a photographer, first big job as a director, meeting my wife, having kids, mm-hmm. moving houses, those kinds of things.
Sure, yeah.
But since so much of your life has been captured on film, is that different for you or is it the same?
Well, yeah, but the thing is that people will ask me about the experience of making a film, and there is the experience, but there's also the experience of who you were in your life at that point. You know, for instance, something like Tremors, okay?
Okay.
You know, silly, goofy movie. Tremors was like a really like intense and heavy point in my life because I was having my first child. I felt that my career was kind of in the shitter. My mother was diagnosed with cancer. I was very like, it was like a passage, you know. So when I think of that movie and I look at that movie, I actually looked at it recently I was hoping to remake it. I see the movie, but really what I see also is this guy who's at this like crazy, like, you know, intense kind of part of his life. So sometimes it's the experiences of the set, and sometimes it's how they're relating to who you are at any given historical moment.
Sure.
Personal history.
It is funny because when you see something from your past, it is incredible how much information is contained in that one photograph.
Yeah.
And having a 3D version of that in a film is, you know, I would think one of the misconceptions of your life is that people meet you and they think you're the sum total of your movies, but your movies may be a sum total of all the other struggles you went through in your life, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that it's to be able to have worked at all, I feel completely grateful for. I never take it for granted. When I started out, I knew that this was the only thing that I was going to do. I knew that this was the thing that I had to do. It wasn't like I was kind of flirting with it for a little while. And,
oh, you knew right off.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to be an actor.
I knew. I mean, I think I knew, honestly, before I knew what an actor was. I mean, I would wake up as a little kid, as a baby almost, I think, and sort of think about being watched in a weird way.
Really?
Yeah. Like I would walk into a room and, you know, want people to see me. You know, laugh at me or connect in some sort of way. To me, that was like the earliest sort of vestiges of wanting to be a performer, you know. And then eventually, when I figured out that you could become other characters, that's when it really, like, really hit me, like, hard. And I was like, I got to do this. So probably I was like, really pretty little kid.
So when you found out you could inhabit other lives and like that was the interest to you. That's interesting because, you know, a lot of people, I guess, would have the idea that if you want to be an actor, maybe it does stop with that wanting to perform and wanting people to see you.
Right.
But it sounds like what you're saying is you wanted to see how many people you could be rather than people just
completely, completely. And it's never been interesting to me to be myself. It's always been, I mean, possibly it's because I don't necessarily find myself all that interesting. But I've always wanted to step into somebody else's shoes. From my earliest memories, I mean, if I went to the theater, saw something in the movies or on television, I couldn't wait to get away from it so that I could go home and pretend to be a cowboy or to be a fireman or to be whatever, a cop or whatever that person was, an Indian, you know what I mean? I almost couldn't absorb those things because I wanted to, you know, play at it.
And when you would go back and do that, did you have this sort of rich imaginative life? Like,
yeah.
Could you lose yourself in it from an early age?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, my mother got me, it wasn't even conscious, but she had this giant box and threw in there scraps, remnants, clothing, hats, you know, pieces of like leather and twine and stuff, and said, "This is your costume box." And I would just open it and put on a costume and, you know, be somebody else.
Was it a lot of solitary time or did you do it a lot with other people?
I didn't really do it so much with other people. I mean, I would do it like around my family. You know, I was always happy to dress up and perform and stuff like that. But not so much around other people. I mean, you know, I mean, that's embarrassing.
Well, did it take a while to find your tribe? Like,
yes. Yeah,
because I think that's a big step, is finding out that you can translate something that you just like to do as a kid.
Yeah.
I've always had a hard time with that. Like, is something I just would be doing if I didn't have to do anything else? What is the thing I want to do?
Yeah.
And right. How is that okay to do and pursue, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you did not come from a performing family. You didn't come from a family that was in the arts at all, right?
No.
So pursuing that, probably you didn't have a pathway to follow so much.
Neither of my parents were in the arts, but both of them had this tremendous appreciation for the arts, music, dance, theater. And they were intensely focused on making us be able to create something on our own. They would get us an instrument, or a costume box, or a dance lesson, or whatever that was, because that was the thing that they put on a pedestal, way more than money, way more than school, than education, academics. They really didn't give a shit about any of that.
Really?
It was all about being creative. To the point where I think it was almost like an undue pressure in terms of that. So when I decided to act and to I started apprenticing at a theater company in Philadelphia when I was probably about, I don't know, 14 or something like that. Just completely found it on my own and went and just swept the floors and stuff like that. They were 100% supportive of it. And when I said, I'm not going to college, I'm going to New York with a suitcase, that's it. They never gave me any kind of shit about that. There was never like, well, you need something to fall back on.
Right, because I think that's the message from most parents, is you need something to fall back on.
Sure.
You need a plan B, you need a time limit.
Yeah.
Give yourself a few years. If it doesn't work.
Yeah.
But that's a pressure on its own, right? Because if you don't make it, you don't have a plan B.
Right. I never had a plan B.
That's amazing.
I never had a plan B. I had two things that were going on simultaneously. The first one was the big dreams, the dreams that you keep for yourself. When you stand in front of the mirror and you accept your Oscar, or you dream about your name in lights, or sitting on the couch with Johnny Carson,
or
money.
Sam Jones.
Yeah, exactly. Or Sam Jones, exactly.
Smaller dreams.
Yeah. I don't know, fancy hotel rooms, jets, all that kind of stuff. And so I had those, and I they were my fantasy life. I would keep them to myself. Then there was the little dreams that you have to have simultaneously. Eating. trying to get any kind of a part at all, even if it's extra work, hoping that you can parlay that into maybe getting an agent,
right.
Then maybe a speaking role, just little kind of baby steps, like chipping away at it. Those two things were always in my mind, and I was like, I think almost freakishly driven to realize those dreams and to get those small baby steps done.
Right. You look at your early career and you stepped in some pretty iconic movies right at the beginning.
I did, yeah. Animal House was my first movie. Yeah.
Animal House and Friday the 13th.
And Friday the 13th, right.
And,
yeah.
And Diner was very early
sure.
on, too.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because you could look at your resume and the misconception would be, oh, after Animal House, he had it made.
And, oh, dude.
And I don't, you know,
boy,
you told
I not
that
have
story.
It made.
But you, that was sort of a one-time thing, and then you went back to your normal life,
I went back to waiting tables and, I had to get the night off to go to the premiere. And no, it was not an overnight kind of success. I mean, I sort of thought it was at the time, But then the reality set in. Friday the 13th, you mentioned. Great movie to have been in just for the fact that, it kind of was a genre. It kind of kicked off an entire, slasher, kind of teen slasher genre thing, And it is sort of an iconic movie, But from a career standpoint, that's not something that puts you on the map. It really isn't. I mean, if you look at, there's a handful of people who were in kind of slasher movies who ended up, you know, having long careers. You know, Johnny Depp was in one, I think, and Jamie Lee Curtis, whatever. But, you know, but it wasn't like a, that wasn't like a slam dunk. I was just kind of like, well, back to being a waiter again. And, right. And Diner, while it was a, in retrospect, a iconic movie, it was not a success at the time. It was really badly marketed and embraced by critics, certainly, but it wasn't Porky's, you know, or American right. Graffiti, or Animal House. And interestingly enough, because that character was so, you know, he was a messed up kid. He was kind of a drunk and you know, sort of a tragic sort of character part. To be able to become a lead actor was a real hurdle. That was my hurdle after Diner, really, was to be considered for, to be the guy.
Right, you're in this ensemble. There's right. a bunch of strong performances.
Right.
And you play a character that's already a little bit damaged and not... That, okay, so that's a big deal to me in terms of thinking about your career, because what I sort of noticed going through everything is that after a giant success like Footloose came mm-hmm. along, that puts you on a completely different path.
Right.
And I think it's really interesting how in this business, your success can often be a bigger imprisonment than a failure can be.
Yeah, it was a path that I really was not comfortable with. I couldn't get my head around it. I couldn't embrace it. I don't know if it was, you know, to be analytical about it, whether it was that I didn't think that I deserved it somehow or whatever. But, you know, I, on top of all this kind of stuff, I had a very idealized image of what the kind of actor that I wanted to be, you know, the kind of movie that I wanted to be in. And it was not Footloose, you know.
Right.
And so I'll tell you a funny story. I think the first movie that I did after Footloose was a movie called Quicksilver, which I don't remember being a very good movie. Some people have said they like it. Maybe they're bike riders or whatever. But Quicksilver was the same producer as Footloose. And I had been kind of, you know, trying to figure out what I was going to do next and, you know, turning stuff down and whatever. And obviously, having been in Footloose, there was a lot of, you know, possibilities, a
sure.
lot of opportunities. And this thing came along, and I met with the director, and he told me that he wanted to make Mean Streets. And this, I was like, okay, this is it. This is what I want to do. Like, that's the, like, Scorsese, Lumet. This is the type of shit that I like, you know, Dustin and De Niro and Al Pacino and you know that whole thing was like where I what I believed in and really wanted to live in that place. And so I read the script. It took place in New York. It's all about a guy on Wall Street who loses all his money, has to become a bike messenger. It's edgy. It's gritty. He's like telling me all about the street and stuff like that. I go out. I get a fixed wheel bike, which is fucking dangerous as hell. I mean, if you're not familiar with it, it's like a, you know,
there's no brakes.
There's
right?
no brakes.
It's just a freewheeling back.
Yeah, you can't coast even, you know. But this was kind of the thing to ride if you were a bike master, if you were hardcore. And I go out and I start riding all over Manhattan, and not actually. I wasn't actually delivering stuff, but I was sort of making friends with the bike messengers, and
right.
I was, you know, getting into that world, right? Doing my research, you know, ride along. Like the first thing that happened was they called me up maybe, I don't know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks before we were going to start shooting, and said, listen, New York too expensive. We're going to be in San Francisco. I'm like, San Francisco? This is the worst fucking idea that I've ever heard. Plus, it's like, it's San Francisco. The difference between San Francisco and New York in the 80s, I guess it was the 80s, was, you know, San Francisco was like a idyllic sort of beautiful.
Rizzaroni.
Yeah, Rizzaroni. Exactly. New York was still like gritty and, you know,
yeah.
and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, we're going to San Francisco. Everything that I was basing the character on, you know, right out the window. I had done all this hanging out on Wall Street, you know, research too. And then partway through they go, you know, it would be really great if we had, it's just, it's not a dance, but it is a kind of pas de deux. Between you, your girlfriend's going to be a ballet dancer, and you're going to be riding a bike. So there was an actual dance sequence that was squeezed in order to try to, you know, cash in on the Footloose thing. And it's like Footloose on a bicycle. I was, you know, just devastated, you know, devastated. And of course, the movie was a bomb. And so I learned, you know, certain kind of lessons from that. Now, you know, if I say I don't look back that often, but if I was to think about that time, you know, I probably should have embraced it a little bit more, you know, embraced this kind of pop stardom, because in a way that was the beginning and end of it for me, was that movie. Because from that point on, the leading man thing really did not work for me. And it wasn't until I said, okay, fuck that, I'm going to be a character actor, that things started to improve again.
That is so interesting, because, you know, you think about, you're what, 26 when you get Footloose or something like that, 25?
Yeah, I think I was, I think I was younger than that. Yeah, I think I was 22 or 23.
Okay. And how do you make good decisions, and how do you navigate that? And and that's pretty much the moments when you go from an actor to a famous person, right?
Yeah.
And then
right.
And you're describing that situation, and it's like The Big Picture, that film you did with Christopher yeah. Guest. It's right. Like that idea that, you know, it's futile in the machinery of this business to think that you can control your image, but I'm sure every kid thinks they can, right? And then you probably saw how Quicksilver was marketed, and mm-hmm. But I wonder if when you were making those decisions, if you felt like a grown-up, if you felt like you had it figured out, or...
Well, I felt like I was a grown-up when I was, you know, 13, honestly. I never felt like a kid. I mean,
really?
I never felt like a kid. You hit the nail on the head, because how do you navigate that stuff? And part of my thing was that I was not interested in other people's opinions about what I should be doing with my career.
So you didn't have someone that, you didn't find that right person to be in your ear that you trusted and had experience?
No. And I think probably they tried, but I think I would be like, you know, no. I was so cocksure about what was right for me and what was wrong for me. And that includes publicity and, you know, agenting and management. For years, I wouldn't even have a manager, because I was like, I don't need a fucking manager to tell me what's, just show me the script and I'll tell you. You know, I was really, really, really like dumb about that stuff. There are people in this world that can help you, can mentor you, can you know, give you valuable advice and guidance, and I would not have it in any aspect of my life. My wife would say, to tell you the truth, she would say that she was my first guide. You know, that was maybe the first time that I was, you know, able to, you know, sort of give myself over to somebody else's opinions.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, and along with that comes her saying, why don't you talk to some other people about this and see if somebody can maybe shed some light.
You mentioned you had sort of a time around Tremors where you had sort of this come to Jesus moment about your career.
Right.
And I had read a little bit about that, and I wondered if, I mean, is that just the life of an actor, to have this feeling that, you know, your career is never safe, and there's always going to be that feeling that your next job can be your last?
Yes.
Or was this a particularly anxiety-filled moment?
I think it was an anxiety-filled moment because of the pressure of bringing a child into the world and of my you know, losing a parent. I mean, I think that's what filled it up. Because, you know, the other thing is that I have looked at, yes, I have this kind of idealistic idea about the kind of actor, you know, that I want to be, and of being taken seriously as an actor and all that kind of stuff. But I also have looked at my life as a job. I mean, I'm very like I'm really like a I want to, you know, work hard for an honest day's work and provide for my family and put food on the table. And you know, I think of myself as a feminist, but I also have a lot of very traditional sort of concepts still in my mind about, you know, me being the provider and the guy that has to bring home the bacon, excuse me.
Yeah.
And so I think that I was looking at that also as like a financial pressure, and so there's all these this confluence of stuff that's coming together.
It's funny how you can see yourself versus how the rest of the world sees you, mm-hmm. and I think about this in terms of, you know, I've pretty much worked steadily my whole life, but
you're freelance too.
Exactly.
So you have that same thing. If somebody is freelance, so. You go, oh shit, this could be it.
Think people look at you and go, well, come on, the guy's worked steadily his entire career.
Of course.
Everyone knows who he is. He's probably got tons of money sacked away.
Right.
And yet the reality is very different, which
very different.
It doesn't matter. None of those things matter. And I wondered if that was something that you still deal with or if it's something that's inescapable as an artist.
I think it's inescapable. I mean, I just don't know any artist who feels like, I've made it, you know. Plus, we also are in a business where people are just, you know, if you're doing well, you know, people are just ready for a fall from grace, you know. And then they want to embrace a so-called, you know, comeback when it happens. And you know, there's a great line, you mentioned The Big Picture, which is a film that not a lot of people saw. It ends up being true again and again and again. So lines always come up to me, you know, in my mind. And there's a moment when Marty Short is my agent, and I play a director, like kind of like a idealistic. Very much, I related to the character very much because he's sort of this. He's not an actor. He's a director, but he has, you know, these ideals about his art and stuff like that. And he starts to kind of get caught up in the commerce of making movies. And I'm trying to get a job, and Marty says something to me like, well, the truth is it's going to be hard to get you a job now because everyone wants to distance themselves from the stench. And that's how you feel. Like if you have three or four, you know, bombs in a row as an actor, you just can't help but feel like people want to distance themselves from the stench. And everybody in our business is a little bit scared, and everybody is, no matter how successful or how powerful you've been, wants to be around the winning team. You know what I mean? So the fact that you have done good work in the past or whatever, it doesn't really matter all that much right now. You know, it's really about what's going on right now.
And that can cycle. Right?
Yeah, that can cycle. So if things are not going well, you get that in your head and you're sitting there and you're waiting for the phone to ring. I find being an actor is strangely unmasculine in a way, I think, because, you know, when you work hard, if you start out as a, you know, a carpenter's assistant or something like that, and you hammer nails for your whole life, and then, you know, you build up a business if you're good at it, and someday you're the contractor and you're the guy that's running the show and you're building the houses and the same thing is, you know, if you're a dentist, you know, you get your dental, you know, office, and you know, that's your thing, that's your baby, you built that. You know, as an actor, like, you're always working for the man, and you're always like, you know, the job ends and you're sitting there, you're sitting watching the phone, I don't care what level you're at, and you're thinking, shit.
Do you still feel this?
Oh yeah.
That's amazing, yeah. To me.
The thing I say to a lot of young people, especially now more than ever, because of the nature of the business and also the possibilities, You really should work on generating your own content, even if it never gets off the ground. Just to say, you know, this is the type of thing I want to do, or look for a book, or see if you can write something, or you know, come up with an idea, you know, pitch or make a small film. I mean, these days, you know, as long as you have an iPhone and a you know, that's all you need is an iPhone. You know,
that's all you need.
Make yourself a movie.
That's the most exciting thing to me about being creative is that. Yes, as an actor, it's tough because you can't act by yourself. But in general, if you can, if you're creative, you can always sit down and you can write something, and you can always draw something. You could always go do something, mm-hmm. and from that little seed could come a whole deal.
Sure.
Right? So
yeah.
I suppose that's the other side of it, of feeling like, because it's very interesting to hear you say you feel like you're working for the man as an actor, you know?
But sure.
I guess it's true because especially for an actor, you just can't go make a solo movie.
No. You have your camera and you get to do your thing, and it's in your hands exclusively in the way that you light it, in the way that you print it, and that, you know what I mean? And there's something kind of amazing about that because, you know, as an actor, as great as it is, we're always in a super, super collaborative kind of situation. And what comes along with that is putting yourself and your work and your heart and your soul and your blood and your sweat and tears into somebody's hands in order to shape it and mold it and, you know, see what's going to happen with it. And I think that's why at a certain point you see a lot of actors who go, I got to direct now because I just can't be the guy that is all day long kind of being treated like a child, and someone comes and does this, and then
right.
someone comes and
right.
does this, and someone takes your hand and makes you cross the street, and you know what I mean? It's like you get to this point where you go, I gotta have some kind of control over of what I'm doing or run the show in some sort of way.
When we come back from the break, Kevin talks about Cop Car, his hillbilly film noir, where the good guys are bad and the bad guys are worse, and Kevin loves them all. Stay with us. And now I'd like to talk to you about my pants. I'm not a guy that thinks much about my pants, other than I try to put them on before I come into the office. And for me, that's the beauty of today's sponsor, Mott & Bow. They send you a couple sizes to try on at home, a magic box full of premium denim on your doorstep for under $100 a pair. Okay, magic might be overstating it, but I didn't have to go to a store and I didn't have to spend any time. I just got some pants in the mail and they fit. I don't know if they'll upgrade me from podcast spokesmodel to photo ads anytime soon, but I do know that if you go to mottandbow.com/offcamera, they'll give you 20% off your purchase at checkout. So give them a try. I mean, where else are you going to find premium quality jeans that fit great for under $100 without the hassle of going into a store? Mott & Bow has the whole denim thing figured out to a science. And if you're a guy like me, that's music to your ears.
You recently did a film called Cop Car, and you executive produced it. You're in it. I would say you star in it, but at the same time, it's such a empty, nuanced, you know, very Coen Brothers, very Tulane Blacktop, Easy Rider type of, you know, it's a spare film.
Sure.
Right? And you know, it's this fascinating story about these two kids who steal a cop car from a sheriff who has obviously got some bad stuff going on, but there's very little information given to the audience.
Right.
And it puts the audience in the same position as the kids, which mm-hmm. is, I mean, I know how to drive, but other than that, I had the same questions they did.
Yeah.
Like, why isn't this guy in his car?
Right.
You know, who's the bad guy? Who's mm-hmm. the good guy? Mm-hmm. Or who's the better of the two terrible guys? Right?
Yeah, right.
And you know, I think, okay, you've been doing this a long time. You take this film with a director who doesn't have a huge body of work. And my first question is, how much more involved are you in shaping that film and making it what it is?
Well, let me first address the issue of it being spare, which is, you know, for a long time, let's put it this way, part of my becoming mature as an actor is not to rate your roles on how many lines that you have. You know, it's, Cop Car is a read between the lines type movie.
Very
and when
much
I
so.
Say lines, I mean the actual lines that I would say. And when I read the script, I started to think about the empty spaces and where my character would live in those spaces from a physical standpoint, you know, expressions and all that kind of stuff. You know, over the course of time, I've gotten more interested in exploring that as an actor. And, you know, things like I did this HBO movie, Taking Chance, which had very little dialogue. The Woodsman had very little dialogue. And a lot of what the dialogue was there, we cut out eventually anyway. You know, Mystic River was kind of a guy who didn't say much, never had a scene where I said, well, I am the way I am because this is what I did. You know what I mean?
Right. There's no exposition that you
right.
feel obligated in Cop Car to let out at all.
Right. So that was interesting to me, if the director was going to be able to capture that. And while I certainly was collaborative with John Watts, I it's not like I came in and, you know, told him how to do it. This is a guy who, at a very young age, and only his second film, was incredibly clear about his vision. Yeah, I mean, I definitely had some ideas, and we started to talk about it. We started to talk about the backstory, and I said, well, let's figure out. What I would say to him, don't get scared, because I'm not asking you for more lines, but let's figure out who this guy is. That's the only way that I'm going to be able to make it work without the lines. If we're really in line, you and I, on what his backstory is, and then in the course of the film, maybe little things will come out, hints about him, and let's see where they live. That was really, really fun. I mean, really fun in its super, super kind of grassroots DIY way.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, isn't that sort of the dream also? I feel like a lot of times on a big set, I mean, I direct quite a few commercials, and sometimes I feel like the crew's in its own way, trying to please people and get everything right. And there's, you know, a million different ways to set up the prop on the kid's bedroom mm-hmm. floor, and
right.
and nine people are going to make the decision. And to me, sometimes I feel like the reason I love being a photographer so much is once I do something like that, it's fun to get back to a small crew.
Sure.
Because you can move very quickly.
Yeah.
Was there some sort of thought throughout that process that, God, this is the way it should be made, it should be done? Or,
well, yeah. I mean, when it's working in that kind of a situation, then it's really great.
Yeah.
When people are really on top of their game, and when you're around young people who really desperately care and really want it to be as good as it can be, then it's fantastic. But, you know, sometimes you get on a small movie, it's like, Jesus, are you kidding me? This is a nightmare.
Sure.
Believe me, it's not always good. But Cop Car was a great, unusual, just kind of experience. And I think, you know, obviously I thought John did a beautiful job. I think it's a cool movie.
Well, you also, you know, you play obviously a guy who's bad news, and it made me wonder about playing a bad guy, or more specifically, a guy the audience is going to root against.
Right.
And
I have no problem with that. Clearly.
but I wonder if you prepare differently when you know the audience is going to root against
no,
you.
Definitely not.
No. You don't.
I don't even think of him as a bad guy. I just can't. I have to just think about everything else but that, you know. Where is he from? What does he care about? What's his family life? What does he want? You know, what's his favorite color? We make a playlist. What kind of tunes does he listen to? You know what I mean? Like, what books has he read, if at all? You know, not bad or good.
Right.
I just don't think about that. I did this movie, The Woodsman, where I was playing a child molester, and people would say to me, well, you were able to make that guy kind of sympathetic. And I said, well, you know what? That sympathetic is not a actable action to me. Like, I could walk into a room horny, hungry, angry, you know, high, all those things. But I can't walk into a room sympathetically. Like,
uh-huh.
I don't know how to play that. What I think is important is to just make somebody a human.
I have so many questions, and I want to talk about The Woodsman too, but I did wonder if there was, you know, back when you were sort of leading man, name on top of the poster all the time, doing these films. Was there a point where you know, a character was brought to you that was sort of not that, and maybe was someone the audience wasn't going to like, where you had to think about it, or?
Yeah, nothing has ever scared me to play. And people have said that before, you know, look, don't fucking do that guy, because...
Well, that's what I wonder, like...
Nah, I don't think...
That agent thing.
Yeah, but you know what? I mean, you know, again, the agents learn pretty quickly that's... I'm just not all that interested in what my own personal... image is.
Your like, marketability.
Yeah,
your...
my marketability, all that stuff. I mean, I probably should be. I mean, I was talking about it in retrospect with Footloose. Like, that's something that I've seen other people parlay into fantastic, powerful careers, and they're still able to do good work. So it's not like that, not like being appealing and marketable makes you a less good actor. It doesn't. But for me, I never saw those two things lining up.
Interesting.
Like, I was like, I don't care what people think of me. It's... my only responsibility as a person is to be good to my family, hopefully compassionate, you know, do what I can in the world. It's not to make myself appealing to people. And then I feel like let the work speak for itself. So because of that, I've never hesitated about playing any kind of a shit or bad person or whatever. And it was actually an agent that one of the great moments in my life was when she said to me, things are not going well with this leading man thing. You need to go back and think about character stuff and forget the leads, forget the price, forget how much you're going to get paid.
So back up a little bit. Explain to me, like, do you get to a certain place and you try to maintain that? Like, this is what I get per movie, and this is what I...
Yeah.
And you were kind of there.
Especially back then, that was the thing. You know, people say, okay, you have your price. You've heard that before.
Sure.
It's way out of his price, right? It has to be a lead. Your name has to be above the title. And the film has to, at that point, was like, it's got to be a studio film. Can't be an independent. Independent films were like, you know, in the 80s. I mean, independent films, you know, they were maybe just starting, you know, to, you know, I mean, I guess Sex, Lies, and Videotape was probably in the 90s sometime. So it wasn't really like, that wasn't a thing, you know. And the independent films were just like crappy films, basically,
right.
You know. I believed in them, but that was not the thing. And so I was really struggling with that, and struggling straight through, you know, Quicksilver and what else? Tremors, and I did this John Hughes movie, and you know, that was a studio film. John Hughes nobody was like hitting him out of the park, you know, more than John Hughes. And
was that She's Having a Baby?
She's Having a Baby, yeah, and that went right in the shitter, and I was kind of like, I don't know what the hell I'm doing here, man. This is just not working. And this agent said to me, you need to do something. You need to forget that whole thing. So it was really, it was like I said, and I've said that I don't really tend to take advice, but this was one of the few times in my life where I did. And she sent me to meet with Oliver Stone, and I did JFK, and that was a complete turning point. I mean, it just turned everything on its head. And not only just like from a career standpoint, but also just personally, I went, okay, gay, fascist, prisoner.
You might as well just get all of them out in one character, right?
Yeah, from New Orleans. I was like, this is great. I'm like having so much fun. I'm doing what it is that I was born to do.
It's almost like you had to find out that it was okay to do that and still be able to make a living or something, right? Like, because I would think that you almost get imprisoned in that idea that, oh, this is who I am and this is how everyone sees me. And because
right.
I look at that, I look at the string of films you did from that point on after JFK. I mean, in there was you know, Murder in the First, A Few Good Men,
right.
Apollo 13, and they're all incredibly interesting pieces of work. And then you get up to The Woodsman. It's kind of the culmination
of
all that work you did, and yet you're in every frame of the film. You're definitely the leading man character in this film, and you have all of that knowledge and ability. I mean, that is a strange film to watch because you didn't do anything crazy with hair or makeup. You didn't do anything crazy with wardrobe, but you're gone, you know? And I think what struck me the most was rooting for him all the way through the film. And when he's bird watching with Robin and he's, you know, you're just even more than for her, you're just hoping he doesn't backslide.
Right.
And then you feel kind of sick, like, wait a minute, why, you know? And right. it's this really fine line. And I wondered, you know, about the process of you making that film and what you took away from it, and also what you put into it. Because, you know, there's also that flash frame where you're beating up this guy that you suspect is a child molester.
It's one of the few times I actually accidentally hit somebody.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And but there's this flash frame of you.
Yeah, beating myself up, right, yeah.
And it comes and goes.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that, I mean, that film is so absorbing because it forces us to look at him as a human, which is exactly what you're talking about.
Exactly what I'm talking about. Well, thank you for saying that. I'm certainly very proud of the movie. I was in the Caribbean. I was walking down the beach, and this guy that I had seen at this resort for a few years in a row came to me. He was from Philadelphia, and he says, "Hey, Kevin, let me ask you something. Somebody gave me a script and said to me, this is going to get somebody an Academy Award. I don't know anything about movies, but would you be all right just reading it for me and telling me whether you think it's something that would be good for me to invest in?" This was a guy who had made a lot of money in real estate or something like that in Philly. And I was in a good mood. I said, yeah, send it to me. I don't normally like take scripts from strangers on a beach in the Caribbean, but I said, yeah, what the hell, send it to me. I read it and I went, holy shit. And the thing that I was knocked out about was the very last scene, which you alluded to, between me and this little girl, is like, it's so tense. It's as tense a moment to me on page as, you know, any action movie, or you're gonna fall off the cliff and you're holding somebody's hand. And
absolutely.
It's like that tense. I said, if we can, like, make that work, then I think we can back a movie up from that point. But that's the thing that has to. And when I read it, and this doesn't always happen to me, I went, I know exactly how I'm going to play it. I got it. Like, I got that, you know? I've got that moment. So if I can make the rest of it lead up to that, I think it'll be an interesting movie. The producer is Lee Daniels, who...
The butler.
Yeah. I called Lee up, and he said, "You're out of your mind." He said, "Your agent's not going to let you do this movie. If I was your agent, I'd tell you not to do this movie. What the hell do you want to play a pedophile for?" I said, I just think it's the first time. He's like literally like the producer of the movie trying to talk me out of it. And I showed it to Kira, and she read it and said, "You have to do it." She said, there's no question. So I started to meet with Nicole Cassell, and surprisingly, she was kind of shocked, I think, that I was interested, and never in a million, it was a tiny, tiny little movie, never thought that she would get, stars to do it. But she had always hoped that Kira was going to do that part. She had Kira in mind for the woman's character.
Right, Kira plays a woman you meet
at
the beginning of the film that works at your same lumberyard.
Yeah, and we have this kind of strange love affair, if you could call it that. We were talking before about, reading between the lines and dialogue. And there was a scene I remember that was this big kind of heavy scene between me and Kira where we're fighting, we're talking and, you know, going through this whole thing. And it was on page, it was kind of the emotional sort of end of the second act, in a way, climactic kind of moment. And, you know, the type of thing where you just go, oh, yeah, yeah, baby, here, look at this. I can really sink my teeth into this. You know, here comes my Oscar, you know, that kind of, like, scene. And as we started to rehearse it, through the course of the rehearsal, we would cut it back and we'd say, no, I don't really need to say that, but why am I saying cut that back? But would he really talk about himself in this way? Cut that back. And we ended up with a really pared down scene. We shot the scene. And, you know, I thought we both acted the shit out of it and, you know, whatever. And then when it actually got to the edit, the only thing that happens is a couple of words and she reaches over and puts her hand on my hand. And honestly, it's so much more powerful than if we had done this big kind of, you know, yakking at each other.
You know, that I remember that scene, and what you're describing would not have fit the tone of that film at all, because it's such an interior film.
It's an interior film,
but,
right.
But what's amazing is how much you're able to convey without saying anything, and how, you know, you talked earlier about not being able to act sympathetically. But what you did do and what you talked about doing is you made this guy a human.
He's a human being. Well, look, here's the thing. Traditionally in films, if you want the person that you most want the hero to kill, make him a pedophile. If you get to prison, that's the guy that everyone's going to say, yeah, fuck it, kill him. You know, that's how we feel about it. It is, and it's visceral. I get it, man. If you have kids, you really feel that way. You'll see people all the time saying, he's a monster, he's a monster, he's a monster. What I thought to myself was the much scarier idea is not that he's a monster. The scariest idea is that he's a human being, that he could be, you know, your teacher. He could be your priest. He could be the guy that's...
not wearing a tag that says monster.
Right, right. If he was a monster, we could send... special, you know, laser guns and robots and stuff to kill. You know what I mean? But he's not. He's a guy. He's a guy, and the pervasiveness of child abuse in our culture continues, and it's cyclical. It's cyclical, and it's. It's a disease that happens to regular kind of people, you know.
Yeah,
what
was your takeaway from that experience once the film came out and all is said and done?
Well, I mean, the only hope that a film like The Woodsman has for, you know, however you're going to define success, whether it be financial or otherwise, the only hope that something like that has is if it's embraced... you know, critically and as an awards consideration type movie. But not only was the film tough, you know, to watch, it was really hard for people to even want to push play, you know. I mean, we sent the video, the DVD out, and nobody even watched the DVDs, you know what I mean? And
you mean the screeners?
Yeah, the screeners.
Academy members,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, I know. I sat with plenty of Academy members who said, I couldn't watch that one, you know.
Just thinking they knew what it was going to be about.
Well, just the idea of a movie all about where the lead character is a child molester. I think because it was... such an important story that sort of had to be told, and such an opportunity to do something that I hadn't really in this way explored before. I didn't really think about, like, yeah, but nobody's going to fucking watch it.
Right, you sort of got blinded by, I have to do this role because I know how to do it.
Yeah.
But isn't that the best way to be an artist is to make a choice purely based on the fact that if anyone else did it, like, you would regret forever that you, because you knew you were
exactly
ready for it or something?
Yeah, no, you're right about that. You're right about that. I did. And you're right. Sometimes you have to put yourself right through that exact same process, and you go, if anybody else did this, am I going to be cool with it? And The Woodsman was a perfect example that I was like, nope. I gotta have this one.
Well, it must be tough to swallow though, because I consider it to be your best work ever, and
I always choose to do my best work in things that nobody will see.
Well, that's the thing.
That's my MO.
Hey, after the break, Kevin and I talk about how he went reluctantly into his first television role and came out with one of the best things that ever happened to him. So stay tuned. As a young photographer, my first website looked suspiciously like a leather case full of chrome slides. But when the internet was invented and the time came to build a virtual version, I asked myself, what do I want in a website? I'm a photographer, so it has to look beautiful. I run a business, so it needs to be simple and unannoying for people to use, including me. You know what I also wanted? Someone to build it and run it for me at a fee that wouldn't break the bank. Well, I'm not bitter, but I sure could have used Squarespace then. Save yourself, folks. If you or your business or your dog needs a website, Squarespace offers simple tools to design professional-looking sites regardless of skill level, all with no coding required, so you don't need to ask your 8-year-old for help. Some of the world's most respected brands rely on Squarespace for beautiful sites and 24/7 online support, all for only $8 a month. So go to squarespace.com and start your free trial site today. No credit card required. And when you decide to sign up, be sure to use the offer code OFFCAMERA to get 10% off your first purchase. You'll really want to do that if I tell you how much I spent per month on my first website. Suffice to say, it wasn't $8 a month. Thanks, Squarespace, for your support of Off Camera. Squarespace, build it beautiful.
It's funny, you've had a long enough career that you were able to sort of see how films were made in the 80s and how films were made in the 90s, how independent cinema came up and became respected, and how television changed. And, you know, I always think of the photographer Richard Avedon, who the very first picture he shot and developed and printed was the same process he used on the very last picture. Like, the technology, nothing ever changed for him. Mm-hmm. But you've been alive and working in a state of incredible change.
Yes.
And I think one of the best ways to bring it home is, in the 70s and 80s, adults went to movies and kids watched television.
Right.
And now, kids go to movies and adults watch television.
Interesting, yeah, that's right, that's a good point.
But, you know, there was obviously this stigma attached to doing television
right.
from a big group of actors. You know, basically, you coming up, it's that series of misconceptions that you have to knock down. You have to knock down name above the poster means I'm successful
sure.
to movies, to this or that, and
yeah.
then you recently decided to do television.
Right.
And I, you know, you've talked about this and watching The Wire and The Sopranos, and of course, television is way more compelling now than going to the movies
sure.
for the most part. I always think it's interesting when somebody who's not super, you know, at the beginning of their career, but they really have a body of work, decides to do something that is new.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how your process changed or what you got out of going into a new medium that you hadn't really explored that much.
Yeah.
And
well,
if it sort of keeps you feeling like you could still do new things.
Yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right about that. It was a new thing. I mean, I did The Guiding Light and Search for Tomorrow back in the 70s, but that was a whole other thing.
So obviously your TV stigma had a basis in reality.
Well, yeah, it did have a basis in reality for sure. Once I was able to walk away from the soaps, I was like, I'm never looking back. I mean, they were good for me at the time because they were able to pay the rent while I was doing theater in New York and exploring all these kind of, you know, offbeat, wacky characters that was really the basis of what I ended up doing in films was really started on the stage. But they came to me for the Animal House television series. And I was trying to decide between that and a walk-on 2-minute role in an off-Broadway show. Not even an off-Broadway show, it was like workshopping an off-Broadway show. And obviously, to go out and do a television series from a movie was going to be way more money than I ever really dreamed of, you know, and I'm sure it wasn't even a good deal, but I was like, oh shit, this, you know, and they're like, well, you're gonna, you know, you'll sign on for 7 years and all that kind of stuff. I had the wherewithal back then to to say no. And it was a very, very, very different time. For one thing, I was making a decision to be a quote-unquote New York actor, whatever that was. I wasn't going to go to California. And I wasn't going to do television. And I saw a real dividing line between serious actors in New York who were on the stage and doing movies and California television actors.
And Chips.
Yeah, right, exactly, Chips, yeah. And I was a complete, you know, snob about it. And that continued. It continued and it continued and continued, even when I was, you know, started getting into shows like, you know, The Wire and et cetera. Kira got onto her show, and for 7 years I watched her process, and it was very, and I was also directing them.
Right.
So I was really, I started to see creatively what it was kind of giving her. And, but I have to say that it was hard-earned snobbery that I had about it. So when I finally picked up the phone and called and said, okay, I'm interested in exploring this option, it was a hard call for me to make. I felt like it was a failure. I felt like it was throwing in the towel. I used my agents, they would not come to me with a series offer because they were afraid I was going to fire them because I, you know, would hit, you know, I'd blow a gasket, you know, if someone said, well, here's a TV series, I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about?
I'm Kevin Bacon.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So, and then the second I hung up the phone, I got maybe three pilots, you know, like the next day or something like that. And I was like, this is the best shit that I have read in years. All three of them, or four of them, were fantastic, great parts, really interesting worlds, really, really cool stuff. And, you know, none of them ended up working out, whatever. And then I went, okay, what have I been waiting for? But from an actual working standpoint, I really enjoyed the work. And the reason is that, you know, one of my favorite times ever is the time between action and cut. And I started to see that the amount of time in my life that I actually spent in that magical place, it's kind of shrinking. You know, they don't make as many movies anymore. And if you get on something that's big, you know, you're only going to do, you know, a page or half a page a day, and there's so much time in the trailer, and there's so much, you know, stuff. And then it's like all you're doing is hoping for that moment between action and cut, and it just seems like it's never coming. You know, you're promoting things, or you're traveling, you're doing everything but that thing that you really want to do. And you get on a TV series, and it's like I get to work, and I don't even see the inside of the dressing room or the trailer. I'm like, I run to the set, we rehearse, I run into, you know, hair and makeup, I'm changing my clothes, I don't even have my fucking pants on, and they're knocking on the door, and we turn around, and there's like 8-10 pages, you know, 14 hours later, I'm on my way home. And yeah, it's exhausting, but it's also, from a creative acting standpoint, it's exhilarating. And it's that thing where, if you really know the guy, you know, you can just go and be him, like again and again and again, and show different colors and show different sort of transformations, creatively, really, really fun, exhilarating.
Well, I also want to talk about, I mean, one of the things I love about you and about any artist that doesn't stick with one thing is that you also play music, and you answered one of my questions, which is, you know, did you have a conflict when you were young? Did you want to be a musician and an actor? But you sort of answered that for me, that you knew you were going to be an actor. But I would argue that you play in a band with your brother called mm-hmm. the Bacon Brothers, and you have for a long time. And it's a serious deal. It's not sort of a lark. I mean, you guys make records, you tour, and you've been doing it a long time. I play music as well, and I've played in bands all my life, and I got to thinking about the level that you're at in this other artistic field and how that influences in a good or bad way going off and doing, you know, doing a project like that that you're incredibly serious about, but it's clearly not your day job. I would assume in the beginning of doing this, a lot of people are there to see Kevin Bacon, the actor.
Sure, yeah. I mean, still, we still, you know, I think to a certain extent still do that. We go someplace that's new and, you know, I mean, people will come out just because it's they want to see the actor. So,
Did you ever have that feeling, though, of like when you fall in something like that, it feels like the fall is much harder because it's not the thing you're supposed to be doing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a risky, dangerous thing. And to get on stage and pick up your guitar and sing in front of people, it's fucking terrifying. I mean, you know, especially for me, the first time I did it, I was like, this is... And it's that feeling that something can always go wrong. You can always break a string. You can always forget a lyric. You can always have a heckler. You can always have a bad PA. You know, a thunderstorm you're playing outside, the lightning. You know, that's that thing, which... I think in a way I was sort of missing the butterflies because to me a movie or a television set is really very, very comfortable place for me to be. I mean, I may be going dangerous places physically or emotionally, you know what I mean? But in terms of like a place to be, it's not like I walk out going, oh, I got butterflies.
That's your world.
Yeah, that's my world. I mean, I think that on the stage you still, you know, playing live is a lot like doing theater in that you go, okay, here we go, half hour, okay, you know, five, you know, places, please, all that kind of stuff. Oh, shit, what's going to happen? And then subsequently you get that kind of exhilaration. That and there is no precedent, as far as I can tell, for any kind of love for an actor being in a band. People go, well, that must be great because it helps you. It doesn't help at all. I think on the contrary. I mean, people, because I'm the same guy. I mean, I go... Oh, and he's got a band? Oh, shit, I can't wait to hear this shit. Oh, boy. You know what I mean? It's just, that's, I believe that music is on a kind of pedestal in our lives that is hallowed ground. Every one of us, worships somebody musically in a way, you know, that, you know, and I know it because I feel it, you know, if I meet, you know, the biggest movie star in the world, it's not like meeting a Rolling Stone or a Beatle. You know what I mean? It's just not the same thing. It's like most people I think in their life has looked at, Tom Cruise and gone, you know, if I look like Tom Cruise, I could probably do what he does. You know, I'm sure that, you know, right? It's acting. It's not the same thing. Nobody looks at Bruce Springsteen and says, yeah, I could definitely do what Bruce Springsteen does.
Right.
You know, everyone's tried to do a little karaoke or tried to pick up an instrument. It's fucking hard, you know? I think most people know that. So that sliding from actor into music is a much more difficult sort of transition, I think, in people's minds. You know, when I started out as an actor, I had a idea that I was going to be part of a brotherhood, of a community, And I think that in the course of my life, I've realized that certainly the film business is a fairly isolating thing, sadly. Every once in a while, you get into a situation where you really feel like an ensemble and you really feel like you're a team. But a lot of times, it's very hierarchical. You know, someone's trailer is bigger than somebody else's trailer.
Right.
Someone is called number one. You know, I'm number one, you know, at work.
On the call sheet.
On the call
sheet.
You're
number one.
Yeah,
right.
So here comes number one. You know, number one is, there's like all this kind of like subtle sort of stuff. And if I go off and I, you know, do a movie with Jeff Bridges and Ryan Reynolds, I'm not number one anymore. I may be number five or something, you know. And yeah, we're all there doing it together, but people take... You know, you want a job that somebody else wants and all that kind of stuff. And I found it to be, it didn't pan into the kind of brotherhood that I wanted it to be. Music, on the other hand, musicians, you kind of have to play together. Do you know what I mean about that? It's like you have to be listening to each other. You have a front man for sure, and I'm sure that, you know, since it's not my only career, I can sort of say this a little bit more, you know. And maybe I would feel more sort of, you know, resentful about it if that music was my only career. But you have to kind of groove, you know, you have to listen to each other. And there is a kind of feeling of more of a brotherhood, I think, among musicians. I also find that the musical, other musicians in the musical world is just kind of more welcoming. Very early in our band, when we put it together, and we were just kind of driving around to little coffee shops and you know, crappy places playing tunes, we got this call to come out and be on a live broadcast of Elizabeth Taylor's, I think it was her 60th birthday. It was going to be a big tribute to her. And they, I don't know how they even found us, but they wanted us to be out there. And somehow they partnered us with Martina McBride, a great country singer. And I had this song that I wrote. And the song starts with this, you know, kind of like little lick, and I was playing a 12-string, and I really hadn't been playing guitar for very, very long when we put the band together. I just I just kind of picked it up to try to write with, you know. I mean, it was like a more of a tool, and my brother said, "You're going to play guitar in the band." I was like, "I can't fucking play the guitar." He's like, "Well, you get to work," and, you know, I started playing. He's a great guitar player. And we rehearsed it, and it was really good. Rehearsal was great, and we're standing backstage, and they're wheeling Roseanne Barr out. A bunch of Nubian slaves are carrying her, and she's dressed as Cleopatra. So it's already kind of like a surreal sort of experience. And there's Elizabeth Taylor down there, and there's Michael Jackson sitting next to Elizabeth Taylor, you know, holding her hand. And we're on stage waiting to the downbeat with Martina, and we're going to sing this song. And I just fiddle just a little bit. And this 12-string acoustic guitar had gone way out, especially on the two top strings, the two top E strings. They were like
way out of tune.
Way out. And I'm not great at tuning guitar without a tuner anyway, but a 12-string,
impossible.
I mean, impossible. And I looked at my brother like, oh my fucking God. And the whole song starts with this lick on the high E string. And so Shirley MacLaine introduces us, and it was just the worst time. And that was a moment when I thought, this is insanity. I shouldn't be doing this.
And you're there, and everyone, I'm sure you're, you know, Michael Jackson, all these people, and right. It's like, well, that's Kevin Bacon. He's playing the right. guitar. He just doesn't sound very good.
Yeah.
That's got to be much harder.
It was hard. It was horrible. I mean, to say that, you know, I shit the bed would be the understatement.
Well, I mean, it's sort of a testament to who you are, though, that you did it anyway. Because even if you had played it great, it's still that same scrutiny, right, that you have for anybody who's an actor and then they go off and do something else.
Well, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Oh, there you go. Well, listen, I could have you on every week, and we wouldn't even get into half your movies and half of what you've done. And I really appreciate you coming on. And
thanks for having me. It's fun.
No, it's great. And you know, it makes me want to go back and watch everything, because hearing some of these stories, it makes me want to, you know, just sort of see what now I know. Because I think, like anyone else, you have perceptions about somebody as an actor until you meet them and until you understand what they were doing. And you kind of see their work in a whole new light when you know them a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of an advantage of being able to do this.
Yeah. Well, I can also tell you that it's such a luxury to not just have, you know, a 4-minute segment and then a break for a commercial and have a 2-minute segment. It's, you know, as you know, easy as that can be, because it's over quickly. It is nice to be able to have, you know, a conversation, because, you know, I care about the work, and it's not that often that, you know, you get a chance to talk about it at length,
right.
Really. So I think what you're doing is fantastic.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank you very much. Well, come back anytime.
Thanks.
Bring your wife, bring your kids.
All right, cool.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Thanks a lot.
All right.
Hey folks, you've reached the end of another episode of Off Camera. I hope you're liking the show. And remember, if you want to get the full off-camera experience, go to offcamera.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @OffCameraShow or me at Sam Jones. And if you want to get really personal, send me an email, sam@offcamera.com. And if you're not already subscribed to this podcast, go to iTunes and subscribe. And while you're there, take a minute on iTunes and give us a rating. Anything above 4 stars is acceptable. And be sure to join me next time when I sit down with actor, writer, and director Dax Shepard.
I'd had a lot of stepdads. I had been around a lot of violent people growing up. I really believed the world was all wolves. What perfectly sums us up is if we meet a stranger on the sidewalk, Kristen and I, and he comes up and says, excuse me, my first thought is, what does this fucker want? Her first thought, sincerely, is, this guy might cure cancer. That's so different from the world I came from, that she really opened up like a whole other side of the world that I truly didn't know existed.
Don't miss one of the most candid off-camera conversations to date, as Dax talks about risk, recovery, relationships, and the surprising effect they'd had on his life and work. See you next time, off-camera.